I'm Bing Crosby.
Hooray for the wine bar.
Yeah, drag out the cooking sherry for the old colonel.
Oh yeah, Bing Crosby. Wow, we're still using that introduction he did from years ago for the old colonel. All right, well, welcome back to the second half of The Promise of Tomorrow here on the Science News Radio Network, exploring the business of emerging science, nanotechnology, open innovation. I'm your host. I'm Colonel Mason, and we really do have nanotechnology to explore in this half hour. In 2006. This radio program and the Science News Radio Network was responsible for producing probably the finest nanotechnology conference ever in the United States in Dallas, Texas. And on stage were six Nobel laureates in a fireside chat moderated by Jim Von Ehr, the founder of Zyvex Corporation. And during the course of the year, we're going to replay excerpts from that. And we have, maybe a 20-minute clip here in just a little bit we're going to plug into. And don't forget, those of you who are listening on radio, you can hear us commercial-free online anytime at promiseoftomorrow.biz. I want to remind you also of the IEEE 2016 International Conference on Homeland Security that's going to go on May 9th through the 12th at the Westin Hotel in Boston. Actually, it's in Waltham, Massachusetts, but that may as well be Boston. And so in 2006, the Science News Radio Network helped produce the largest nanotechnology event, certainly in Texas, maybe the United States, and quite frankly, held in Dallas. And our moderator introduced six Nobel laureates on stage at the same time for a fireside chat, along with moderator Jim Von Ehr, founder of Zyvex Corporation.
That will be joining Jim up here for our fireside chat. Dr. Alan McDermott, who was awarded the Nobel Prize in Chemistry in the year 2000. He's currently at UT Dallas. Dr. Robert Curl Jr., who you got to see on the video, awarded the Nobel Prize in Chemistry in 1996 for his co-discovery with Dr. Smalley of the Buckyball, and he's at Rice. Dr. Michael Brown, awarded the Nobel Prize in Medicine in 1985, currently at UT Southwestern Medical School in Dallas. Dr. Alfred Gilman, awarded the Nobel Prize in Medicine in 1994, professor and chairman of UT Southwestern Medical Center in Dallas. Dr. Russell Hulse, awarded the Nobel Prize in Physics in 1993, visiting professor at UT Dallas. And Dr. Farid Murad, awarded the Nobel Prize in Medicine in 1998, University of Texas Medical School in Houston. Please welcome Jim and our Nobel laureates to the stage, please.
At this time, the Nobel laureates took the stage, and moderator Jim Von Ehr began the conversation.
Well, gentlemen, what a group. I don't know if you'll ever see six Nobel laureates in one place other than maybe if you go to Stockholm. So I think it's quite an amazing event to... We have a pretty wide variety of their fields, and I'd just like to ask each of them to basically start by telling us very briefly a little about what they have done and what they're doing since they won the Nobel, because this is a great platform from which to get attention from the world, and people who didn't listen to you before suddenly think that you're the smartest person on the planet. And it's kind of interesting to see what people do with that kind of pulpit. And we heard some about what Jack Kilby and Rick Smalley did with their pulpit. They were able to stand and talk about some things they thought were important. So I'd like to ask each person, Alan, let's start with you. Alan McDermott.
Okay, thank you, Jim. I'd firstly like to point out that I don't normally travel with this. This was due to a piece of ice, and in one second it changed my life, but pretty soon I'm going to throw all this away. I think the presentation just made is very, very wonderful to two of our great scientists, Rex Morley and Jack Kobe. As a matter of fact, one of the transparencies that I use in my lectures is directly from Rex Morley. And this is a transparency that some of you may have seen. It is headed up the 10 greatest problems or challenges facing the world today: energy, water, food, etc. So my interests at the moment bear both on nanotechnology and on renewable energy. And I think as we go into the rest of this century, we'll find that the area of nanotechnology becomes increasingly important in the energy of renewable, in the area of renewable energy. And I think that we will see and hear more about both nanotechnology and renewable energy in the next 2 or 3 days. It's an exciting time to be alive in, and I wish I were only 40 years younger.
Dr. Curl.
Well, I thought the video was a wonderful tribute to both of these gentlemen, and of course, having had the experience of working with Rick for years, it was particularly satisfying to me to see this video and see him. Recognized and getting him the attention that he so richly deserved. Let me pick up for a moment on this transparency that Professor McDermott shows. Rick, even before the nanotechnology initiative, became concerned about world problems and decided that energy was really going to be the problem in the next 50 years as we run out of supplies of petroleum and natural gas. And he had made a tremendous effort to get something started now so that we would be somewhere that we would not be shocked and surprised and have some sort of crash program in the future. And the problem in the energy field is there aren't any easy answers. The work on solar cells has been going on for a long time. There's a lot of progress, but the progress has been incremental in general in terms of practical systems because of costs. And also there are the issues that the sun goes down every night, which means that not only do you have to solve the problem of having an economical solar cell, but you have to recognize that it's not going to be there all the time. And the other major problem is that where you have really bright sun, like the deserts of Arizona, Nevada, New Mexico, parts of New Mexico and parts of West Texas are not where the people live in general. So you have the issue of long transmission. So this is an incredibly important thing and should be, we really need some sort of Apollo-type program to address these issues. So that's my commercial. I just wanted to get that across. As for what I'm currently doing, is I've sort of left chemistry in a certain sense and become an engineer, which is bothers me a lot because ordinarily science is permanent and engineering is transitory. But on the other hand, if you're somebody like Jack Kilby, your engineering can be permanent as well. But what I'm doing at the moment is I'm working in two areas. One is working with a colleague, Frank Tittle, in the area of developing portable, sensitive trace gas sensors based upon quantum cascade lasers. And these are going to make a big difference in lots of areas. There are medical applications, there are process control applications, there are environmental applications, or even agricultural applications. The other thing that I'm doing is working on a different approach to medical imaging. This is primarily, well, actually I'm working with somebody at Baylor College of Medicine who is trying to develop a DNA sequencing process based on sequencing by synthesis, Mike Metzger, and this imager is part of that, aimed at that, but it's also potentially maybe useful for people who are doing gene expression work. It's strictly engineering. There are excellent imagers currently available. This is just an idea that I had, that one could make use of the higher power that lasers have by a different approach.
Okay, thanks. Moving from chemistry to medicine, Dr. Brown?
Well, I thought the film was fascinating in the juxtaposition of these two individuals. I mean, in their personalities and in the ways that they use their Nobel Prizes afterwards. Kilby, sort of a shy, retiring person, obviously a force within Texas Instruments, but probably not a salesman outside, not of the company, whereas Rick Smalley, who I finally got to know when, as you heard from Senator Hutchison, he and I were the two founding members of the Texas Academy of Medicine, Engineering, and Science. He was an outgoing personality and somebody with a very forceful personality and a person who could, as you heard, move mountains in terms of getting people to do things. So it's fascinating, and when people receive the Nobel Prize, they're faced with the question of, what do I do now? And I have a scientific partner, Joe Goldstein, and we were fortunate to receive this prize when we were quite young. In 1985, I was only 44 years old. And, you go through all these celebrations and, you're honored and have all this enormous attention, especially when you go to Stockholm. And like Cinderella, at midnight, your coach turns into a pumpkin and you come home to Texas and, basically come to work. I think if we'd have lived in Germany, we would have a chauffeured limousine for the rest of our lives. But in Texas, even though it was the first Nobel Prize for work done in Texas, basically, the next day you sit down and you say, now, what do we really enjoy doing? What is the thing that you look forward to? Do you want to go into administration and become a university president? Do you want to start a company? Do you want to change the world in some way? We probably were very selfish. We decided that what we enjoyed doing was walking into the building early in the morning and having some excited graduate student or postdoctoral fellow running up to us with some result of an experiment that they had done the night before. So excited. And realizing that experiment would open a whole new avenue into our understanding of the world. And so that's what we've done, for the 21 years since then. We're basically exactly where we were on the day that we got the phone call, and that's what we're doing. We do have some outside consulting work, and we're on boards and things, but our focus has stayed in terms of continuing to do science. I think in contrast to some of the scientists you've heard about who had one moment of brilliant inspiration, we're just not that fortunate. We spent many years doing the work that received the Nobel Prize. It was a painstaking and laborious effort to try to understand how the body controls the level of cholesterol in the blood and how genes affect the level of cholesterol in the blood. And of course, everybody says, oh, well, that work was so important because, it led to certain drugs to lower cholesterol, and we're very happy about that. But I have to say that that was not our motivation. Our motivation was to solve a puzzle. We saw two children with very, very high levels of blood cholesterol who were having heart attacks at age 6 and 8, and we just wanted to figure out what was wrong. And that was our motivation, and the fact that it helped people, and of course we're obviously delighted, but that was not our primary motivation. And I think we need to understand that in science, everything is not directed toward a practical goal. The nanotechnology, you know, the focus of this is on engineering, on building the Hoover Dam rather than thinking about the Hoover. I'd like to be the beaver rather than the engineer who built the dam, but we need both. Obviously, we need beavers and we need builders, and I'm afraid we're losing the beavers in our society because of the way we educate students in science. So if I have a secondary interest, it's in education, scientific education. But I think we need to encourage people to just think and solve problems just because it's fun to solve problems and not necessarily because it's going to lead to a cure for cancer. Cures for cancer will come when we understand the world better.
Well, you've answered one of my other questions and led into another one later, but I just want to pick up on something you said, that the kind of Cinderella world that you enter. I had the privilege of traveling in China with Dr. McDermott several years ago, and I can say just being in the entourage of a Nobel laureate traveling in China is something to behold.
Well, I had that experience. I'll tell you my experience. Joe Goldstein, my scientific partner, and me and another Nobel laureate, Phil Sharp from MIT, were invited to Beijing and Shanghai, and we went there. And when we went to Beijing, and of course we were, you know, treated with some respect, and we gave a lecture in a reasonably sized auditorium with students. And then that night, there were three other people there, the three tenors. And the three tenors had an audience of 50,000 who paid up to $10,000. And the three Nobel laureates drew about 200 people. So, but let me just say one other thing, since you brought up China. I don't want to monopolize this, but one other thing about science. When we were there, wherever we went, the students kept asking us, when is China going to get our first Nobel Prize? And when is China going to get our first Nobel Prize? Now, at the time we were there, they were competing for the 2012 Olympics, and they had signs all over and posters and everything. You know, Beijing Olympics 2012, or whatever year, 2008. But the fact is, so what we said to them is, listen, when you're in the Olympics, when you're competing in the Olympics, winning the race, winning the prize is the goal. When you're doing science, the goal is to understand something about nature, and the prize is a piece of dessert that comes after the main course. But it's not, if it's your goal to begin with, and I think all of us would agree on that, if it's your goal to begin with, if you're doing science just for the sake of, boy, if I could discover this, I'll get a prize, the chances are overwhelming that it will never happen. You've got to be driven by the curiosity. Well, it didn't go over well in China. They're impatient. And they want to win a Nobel Prize tomorrow. And, you know, it takes a long time to build up the cultural infrastructure to encourage people to do the kinds of thinking that you have to do.
Well, thanks. Now, moving to the frontiers of cosmology and physics, Dr. Hulse, you're the youngest guy up here, including me, so you won yours pretty early age.
Yes, I was 43. When I received it, and it was for work I did as a graduate student, actually. I was 24. It was quite a surprise to receive it at the time, especially since I had changed fields since then. And I certainly remembered that work I had done in astrophysics, but it wasn't the immediate thing on my mind when I heard the announcement of the prize. I just wanted to chime in and say I certainly agree with the things that you said about great science comes out of developing a culture, an ecosystem, an infrastructure, whatever. It isn't something you just magically create on demand. I also wanted to say I really did enjoy that film, particularly because I didn't have the privilege of actually personally meeting either of those people. And it was fascinating to hear the story and both of their stories. And it's particularly fascinating for me because, to get back to the question you originally posed about what we're doing and where we've been and where we're going and the influence of Nobel on that, I've always been someone who had a very broad and changing interest in science, and I'm particularly fascinated by interdisciplinary science, which is becoming really more the norm these days, and so it's a very exciting time for me, and the interaction of science with technology. I actually started out, I got my PhD in physics in a department that was very heavily high-energy physics department, but I did my thesis in radio astronomy, and I spent most of my time doing digital signal processing, programming a computer, and assembly language. So that's sort of typical me, off doing a variety of things that hopefully come together in something good. And I was lucky enough as a grad student to have it pay off very big with a discovery that was important for gravitational physics. Since then, I then switched fields and I went to work at Princeton Plasma Physics Laboratory working on controlled thermonuclear fusion research, where actually mostly what I did was atomic processes in plasmas and computer modeling. And when the Nobel came around, it was a pivotal moment for me to think about. And in fact, literally, in my case, it was true. It was on the plane back after this incredible experience, which you touched on. I mean, it's really quite an incredible experience.
We've been listening to a fireside chat with six Nobel laureates featured on stage at the largest nanotechnology event ever produced in Dallas, Texas, 2006. And moderated by Jim Von Ehr, founder of Zyvex Corporation. The Science News Radio Network of this program was proud to be there and help produce the program. The chat went on for an hour and 20 minutes, so we can't play it all at one time, but we do plan to play additional excerpts during the year. And at this time, I want to thank you very much for those of you who have contributed to this program. We depend on contributions from listeners like you for the existence of this show. We're totally science community supported. So those of you who have contributed, thank you very much. Those of you who wish to can do so at our website, promiseoftomorrow.biz. On the right-hand side of your screen, you'll see a little tab there for donations. Just click the donations, and we appreciate all your help.
And now, we make time for the voice of reason. Listener comments, ideas, and suggestions.
I have recently gone through a phase in my life where I am working towards retirement. I'm no longer in my 20s where I had literally, in my 20s, I had racks of servers in my apartment just so I can learn technology and keep up with technology and understand it better. But I'm starting to slow down. I'm in my 50s, and I'm pushing towards another chapter of my life. And I started something as I moved to a smaller paced living area. I started something that a motto that I live by today, which is Naya. And what I mean by Naya is never in a hurry. The bottom line is time is going to move. The clock is going to click. Whether we're part of this world or not, it keeps on going. Technology is changing so fast, and keeping up with technology is overwhelming in a lot of cases. So I tend to now tell people, especially maybe because of where I'm at in my life, but I tend to people, I say, you know what? Naya, never in a hurry. You just got to sit back, relax, and take it in one bite at a time, get as much information as you can, go forward. You're not going to absorb all of technology instantly today. Just relax, pace yourself, and go with the flow. Philip Bardasian, technical sales specialist with IBM, part of the IBM Continuous Engineering for the Internet of Things.
So you decide, has this really been the voice of reason? Listener comments are welcome at 214-329-4949. And please tell us your name and where you're from.
You've been listening to The Promise of Tomorrow with Colonel Mason, the definitive program on emerging and nanotechnologies, now archived and streamed on the web at promiseoftomorrow.biz. Join us next week at the same time as we learn more about the promise of tomorrow.
Waiting for you.